Joshua, chapters 8 and 9. The fifth talk in a series on the narrative portions of Joshua was presented by David Crabtree on November 20, 2005 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2005. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
You're looking at Joshua chapters 8 and 9 today. These are difficult chapters. I'm not sure exactly what to make of, in particular, chapter 9. As I've been studying it, I have gone violently back and forth as to how to take it, and in fact, changed my mind from last night to this morning. So I've decided to make this a work session. I'd like you all to roll up your sleeves. And think about this with me as we proceed through here, and then at the end we can talk about it and you can help me out. We're in Joshua. There has been the conquest of Jericho. Jericho was flattened and burned, and the Israelites had their first big victory in Canaan. Then hot on the heels of that big victory, the Israelites went out after the city of Ai, which they thought would be a piece of cake, and that turned out to be a rout. It was a rout of the Israelites. They turned and fled in the battle. And so that was a big discouragement. After a big success, they had a big failure. And it became clear that the cause of that defeat was sin on the part of one of the members of the army of Israel, who had taken plunder that he was not supposed to take. And so that issue of his sinfulness has dealt with, it was, and now ready to go back to Ai. And that's where the action picks up in Joshua chapter 8. Now the Lord said to Joshua, "Do not fear or be dismayed. Take all the people of war with you and arise, go up to Ai. See, given into your hand the king of Ai, his people, his city, and his land. And you shall do to Ai and its king, just as you did to Jericho and its king. You shall take only its spoil and its cattle as plunder for yourselves. Set an ambush for the city behind it." So God reassures Joshua after the disappointment, "Now we're back on track. Now you will be successful once again," and encourages him to take heart and to move ahead. And he guarantees success. This is going to happen. This is a done deal. You are going to defeat the city of Ai. It's just a matter of going out and doing it. In this instance, he tells the people of Israel that the rules of engagement are different here in Ai. They are able to keep the plunder. I find that rather ironic. That is at Jericho that the problem was that Achan had taken some stuff that he had seen, and as I imagine it, he saw something. He saw this plunder on the ground, and he's thinking, "This is an opportunity that I cannot pass by. This is a truly unique opportunity to have this valuable plunder and take it for my own." They were not to take any plunder from Jericho, but from Ai they can. Had he only waited. I mean, the impatience that we have, that perspective that this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to get something good myself, so I have to violate what God has told me to do. Yet if we're patient, God is very good to take care of and providing us with what we need, even beyond what we need. How is this going to happen? How are they going to take Ai? It's through ambush. So that's what we learn from God's words to Joshua in the first section. Next section. So Joshua rose with all the people of war to go up to Ai. And Joshua chose 30,000 men, valiant warriors, and sent them out at night. And he commanded them, saying, "See, you are going to ambush the city from behind. Do not go very far from the city, but all of you ready. Then I and all the people who are with me will approach the city. It will come about when they come to meet us, as at the first, that we will flee before them. And they will come out after us until we have drawn them away from the city, for they will say, 'They are fleeing before us as at the first.' So we will flee before them. And you shall rise from your ambush and take possession of the city, for the Lord your God will deliver it into your hand. Then it will be, when you have seized the city, that you shall set the city on fire. You shall do it according to the word of the Lord. See, I have commanded you." So Joshua sent them away, and they went to the place of ambush and remained between Bethel and Ai on the west side of Ai. But Joshua spent that night among the people. In this chapter, as in the chapter on Jericho, the author of Joshua is obviously employing the strategy of just leaking out information about what's going on. So as you're reading through it, it's difficult to envision exactly what's happening and in what order. My mind is kind of searching around, trying to find a way to put all this stuff together. And yet you don't have all the pieces to put it together. So your mind is, with each sentence, your mind is scrambling to try to figure out how do we put this next piece of information in. And it's difficult. When all is said and done, it's difficult to put it all together. It's more impressionistic than it is truly descriptive. I think that this is his strategy. I don't think this is an accident. I don't think this is the result of different traditions being haphazardly put together. I think it is intentional. Because of the strategy that he is employing, it's very difficult to come up with a chronology of this event. He has kind of run roughshod over the chronology, and he's just trying to paint this picture where you kind of get a vague understanding of what happened, and it slowly emerges rather than just coming out and telling you. We observe that in the chapter about the fall of Jericho. It's happening again here. So I think it's consistent. But it does make it hard to piece it all together. So I'll do the best that I can. In this first section, I think he is just talking about what God had told Joshua to be the major plan. In the next section, we'll see bits and pieces of it playing out. The first difficulty is, it says that Joshua chose 30,000 men, and then he had them stationed for this ambush. What we'll see in the next section is it says that there are 5,000 men who were stationed for this ambush. There are a couple of possible solutions to this. One is, and this is the one that most of the commentaries that I looked at preferred, that this number is wrong. That here, instead of the 30,000, it should be 5,000. Dealing with large numbers in the Old Testament is problematic. And lots of people have commented on that. That's not something that is only my observation. If you go with the numbers in the Old Testament, the number of the people of Israel that are marching through the wilderness and then into Israel is, I don't remember, but it's over a million. If they're over a million, many people have pointed out that there is not water. There is not enough water at a lot of places that they stopped to provide for that many people. If we just talk about the size of that group, it would be stretched out for miles. When they're coming into Canaan, How could they possibly be afraid of Jericho? Jericho would only add a few thousand inhabitants. As we look at Ai, it had 12,000 inhabitants. How could over a million people be afraid of 12,000 inhabitants? So the big numbers become problematic. I had a little project that I did a few years ago. I received a chain letter, and it was one of those chain letters that said, this letter is bringing you luck, and so-and-so got so many $1,000 after they sent the chain letter on, and so somebody else got so many $1,000 after they sent it on, and da-da-da-da-da. And make 10 copies and send it to 10 people within so many days, and you will get good luck. Then a few days later, I got another one from another place. So I decided, this looks like fun. I'm going to save these. And I saved those. And over the next few years, I got some more of those. And I informed some friends that I was collecting these things. And I ended up with about 10 letters that were all obviously based on the same original letter. Some of them have been hand-copied, some of them have been photocopied, some of them have been mimeographed. Anybody remember a mimeograph? So I collected these because my interest was, what happens, start out with one original, and people keep making copies of these, what kind of errors result? And in looking at those, things so striking is that there were two kinds of errors that were rampant in the letters. There were two areas in which they deviated the most. One was in names, and the other was in numbers. And as I reflected on it and I was looking at them, it occurred to me why that is. That's because words are, to a certain extent, self-correcting. If you misspell a word, the next person coming along knows that that was a mistake, and they can correct it. If it's the wrong word, sometimes it's a word that you would never use in that place in a sentence. Someone coming along next knows that was an error, and they can correct it. But numbers? There's no way to know. If you have a number and there isn't context to tell you how that number was arrived at, so let's say it's how much money somebody won in a lottery because they sent this letter on, it could be anything. So it's not self-correcting. So it's numbers and names that were the most listed in these copies, and that's not very interesting. Numbers are hard to pass on. So is it possible that numbers have gotten messed up in the Old Testament? I think that's possible. I think that's very possible. There's another possibility, and that is, I'm suspicious that we may not know the notation that was used in the original Hebrew texts. I think that knowledge may have gotten lost, and that there's some way that we're messing up how we're putting their numbers into modern numbers. In fact, that got messed up probably centuries ago, and I'm hypothesizing that we may not even know what those original numbers were. In any case, I think there are a variety of reasons why the numbers in the Old Testament might be problematic. In this case, however, there's another possibility, and that possibility is that the number 30,000 isn't describing the number that are to go into ambush. The number that are to station themselves for the ambush is given to us in the next section as 5,000. It could very well be that the total army is 30,000, and I think that would make sense in the context. In any case, what's being said to Joshua is that they are supposed to set up an ambush in which there are some men that are stationed on the west side of Ai. That's between Bethel and Ai. If you've got your maps, you'll see that Bethel and Ai are just west of Jericho, up in the mountains. And Bethel and Ai are separated by about 12 miles, so they're fairly close together. This ambush is supposed to be set up in between Bethel and Ai, on the Bethel side of Ai, on the west side. The main force is going to come down from the north. They are going to attack the city, and they're expecting the army of Ai to come out and meet them. And when the army from Ai comes out to meet them, they're going to turn and run like happened before. And they're expecting the army of Ai to chase after them, at which time the men that are in ambush are supposed to come out, attack the unguarded city, and then they are to light a fire in the city. And apparently the fire that they are initially supposed to light is kind of a signal fire. It's just a show that the Israelites have come into the city. The real earnest burning will come later. So that's the plan, and they begin to array their forces in order to carry out that plan. Next section. Now Joshua rose early in the morning and mustered the people, and he went up with the elders of Israel before the people to Ai. Then all the people of war who were with him went up and drew near and arrived in front of the city and camped on the north side of Ai. Now there was a valley between him and Ai. And he took about 5,000 men and set them in ambush between Bethel and Ai on the west side of the city. So they stationed the people, all the army that was on the north side of the city and its rear guard on the west side of the city. And Joshua spent that night in the midst of the valley. And it came about, when the king of Ai saw it, that the men of the city hurried and rose up early and went out to meet Israel in battle, he and all his people, at the appointed place before the desert plain. But he did not know that there was an ambush against him behind the city. And Joshua and all Israel pretended to be beaten before them and fled by the way of the wilderness. And all the people who were in the city were called together to pursue them, and they pursued Joshua and were drawn away from the city. So not a man was left in Ai or Bethel who had not gone out after Israel. And they left the city unguarded and pursued Israel. So here it's talking about the implementation of the plan that was just laid out. They position themselves at night, so they have crept in under cover of darkness, the men in ambush on the west and the main army to the north. Early in the morning, the army from the north proceeds forward, and the king of Ai says, great, we're going to get them again. And they come out from the city and attack the Israelites. And just as the plan, according to plan, the Israelites turn and begin to run. And just as they had hoped, the king of Ai flees after them. He's overconfident based on the last experience. And he thinks this is going to be a breeze. Chases after them. And it mentions here, all the people who are in the city come out. So they're very confident. And it's not only the people of Ai, but it says, so not a man was left in Ai or Bethel. That's the only mention of Bethel up to now in Joshua. My suspicion is that this is a hint as to why the Israelites were defeated the first time. Remember, they had sent out spies to examine Ai and to scout it out and to figure out how to attack it. I suspect that the spies came back with a report about Ai But in the meantime, the men of Bethel had come and joined the city of Ai to defend it. So when the Israelites attacked with their small force, they encountered a force that was twice the size of what they had expected, because it had been joined by the men of Bethel. In any case, they're here now, and they're coming out after the Israelites as well. So the city is completely unguarded at this point, and the plan is working perfectly. Then the Lord said to Joshua, "Stretch out the javelin that is in your hand toward Ai, for I will give it into your hand." So Joshua stretched out the javelin that was in his hand toward the city, and the men in ambush rose quickly from their place, and when he had stretched out his hand, they ran in and entered the city and captured it, and they quickly set the city on fire. When the men of Ai turned back and looked, behold, the smoke of the city ascended to the sky, and they had no place to flee this way or that, for the people who had been fleeing to the wilderness turned against the pursuers. When Joshua and all Israel saw that the men in ambush had captured the city, and that the smoke of the city ascended, they turned back and slew the men of Ai. And the others came out from the city to encounter them, so that they were trapped in the midst of Israel, some on this side and some on that side. And they slew them until no one was left of those who survived or escaped. But they took alive the king of Ai and brought him to Joshua. So apparently, according to a prearranged signal, Joshua raises his javelin, and the men who are in ambush, they come out, they run into the city, which is unguarded, and very quickly they light it on fire. And this fire is apparently primarily designed to scare the men of Ai, because now they know that the city has been attacked behind them. And also as a signal to Joshua that it's time to turn around and start attacking the people of Ai. So you've got the men of Ai trapped between these two forces, and they don't know what to do, and they see their city burning. They are all cut down, except for the king of Ai, who is taken captive. And he is delivered into the hands of Joshua. Now it came about when Israel had finished killing all the inhabitants of Ai in the field in the wilderness where they pursued them, and all of them were fallen by the edge of the sword until they were destroyed. Then all Israel returned to Ai and struck it with the edge of the sword. And all who fell that day, both men and women, were 12,000, all the people of Ai. For Joshua did not withdraw his hand with which he stretched out the javelin until he had utterly destroyed all the inhabitants of Ai. Israel took only the cattle and the spoil of that city as plunder for themselves, according to the word of the Lord, which he had commanded Joshua. So Joshua burned Ai and made it a heap forever, a desolation until this day. And he hanged the king of Ai on a tree until evening. And at sunset Joshua gave command, and they took his body down from the tree and threw it at the entrance of the city gate and raised over it a great heap of stones that stands to this day. So the Israelites killed them all, every man, woman, and child, a total of 12,000. They take the plunder for themselves. But as was the arrangement in Jericho, presumably all the metal was given to God. They took the king. He was taken captive and he was hanged until sunset. And then according to the law in Deuteronomy, his corpse was taken down before sunset. And he was placed at the gate of the city of Ai and then heaped with stones. So once again, we have another monument. We've got the Israelites are building these monuments as events unfold. And these monuments are are these visual reminders of their history and what God has done in their midst. Then Joshua built an altar to the Lord, the God of Israel, in Mount Ebal, just as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had commanded the sons of Israel, as it is written in the book of the law of Moses, an altar of uncut stones on which no man had wielded an iron tool. And they offered burnt offerings on it to the Lord, and sacrificed peace offerings. And he wrote there on the stones a copy of the law of Moses, which he had written in the presence of the sons of Israel. And all Israel, with their elders and officers and their judges, were standing on both sides of the ark before the Levitical priests who carried the ark of the covenant of the Lord. The stranger as well as the native, half of them stood in front of Mount Gerizim and half of them in front of Mount Ebal, just as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had given command at first to bless the people of Israel. Then afterward, he read all the words of the law, the blessing and the curse, according to all that is written in the book of the law. There was not a word of all that Moses had commanded which Joshua did not read before all the assembly of Israel, with the women and the little ones and the strangers who were living among them. The location between Bethel and Ai is significant in that in chapter 12 in Genesis, Abraham was told by God to go to a land that God would show him. He didn't say where it was. He just said, Abraham, go to a land that I will show you. Moses took off and he went to Canaan. And when he arrived there, he stayed between Bethel and Ai. And having arrived there, God spoke to him again and gave that land to him and his descendants. And in response to that, Abraham built an altar there. So in the narrative here, we are at a significant geographical location that brings to mind the fact that God had given this land to the descendants of Abraham hundreds of years before, and now they're here and they are taking this land. But the ceremony that's talked about apparently is happening, they apparently traveled to the north to do this ceremony because at least historically the designations of these two mountains is up by Shechem. So if you look in your map, it's quite a little trip north. It's probably 40 or 50 miles north of Bethel and Ai. And there, just outside of Shechem, there are the two mountains, Gerizim and Ebal. So they apparently take a trip up there. I don't know whether this is in chronological order with the rest of Joshua or not. It wouldn't have to be, I don't think. But it's possible that they took a break in their conquests and took this trip up to Shechem. And they go through this ceremony that had been prescribed by Moses in Deuteronomy. Let's look at that as soon as I find it. Deuteronomy 27, 1 through 8. In Deuteronomy, Moses is giving them the law once again, reminding them of the law just before they go into the promised land. And as a part of this, he gives them instructions as to what they will do when they go into the land. Verse 27, 1 through 8 in Deuteronomy. Then Moses and the elders of Israel charged the people, saying, keep all the commandments which I command you today. So it shall be on the day when you shall cross the Jordan to the land which the Lord your God gives you, that you shall set up for yourself large stones and coat them with lime and write on them all the words of this law when you cross over, in order that you may enter the land which the Lord your God gives you, a land flowing with milk and honey, as the Lord, the God of your fathers, promised you. So it shall be, when you cross the Jordan, you shall set up on Mount Ebal these stones, as I am commanding you today, and you shall coat them with lime. Moreover, you shall build there an altar to the Lord your God, an altar of stones. You shall not wield an iron tool on them. You shall build the altar of the Lord your God of uncut stones, and you shall offer it on it burnt offerings to the Lord your God. And you shall sacrifice peace offerings and eat there, and you shall rejoice before the Lord your God, and you shall write on the stones all the words of this law very distinctly." So that is what Moses had commanded before they went in, and now they're carrying out their command to perform this ceremony. It is truly remarkable that several hundred years earlier, centuries earlier, God had given this land to Abraham. What were the chances that his descendants would actually come back and take this land? Especially given the fact that in the interim, they had gone down to Egypt and had become slaves in Egypt. How are they going to leave Egypt and reclaim that land that God had given to the descendants of Abraham? And that's what's so significant about the Exodus and this conquest. God kept his promise. It looked unkeepable, but God kept the promise. God is loyal to the promises that he makes. And this ceremony was recognition of that fact, that God keeps his promises despite all odds, and that the Israelites have an obligation to this their God who has been so gracious towards them. Note that there is mention of the strangers on two occasions in this passage. So there are not just the Israelites, but there are these other people who have become a part of them. And we've had hints of that all along. There are indications that there are some Egyptians who came along with them when they fled Egypt. And we've had Rahab who has joined them. And it is very possible that there were others who along the way have become a part of the people of Israel. And they are accepted in. They are a part of this as well, and the same obligations apply to them. Okay, now we read about the Gibeonites. Here's where it gets tricky. "Now it came about when all the kings who were beyond the Jordan in the hill country and in the lowland and on the coast of the great sea towards Lebanon, the Hittite and the Amorite and the Canaanite, the Perizzite, the Hivite and the Jebusite heard of it, that they gathered themselves together with one accord to fight with Joshua and with Israel." Now historically, the Canaanites were always fighting among themselves. They were divided up into city-states. And they would attack one another. And because they were attacking one another all the time, they fortified their cities. It was an area in which there was constant warfare. They couldn't unite. At least they couldn't unite and stay united. But in this instance, they have a common threat. The Israelites are coming. And their response to this fact that the Israelites are coming is after the defeat of Jericho and Ai, now they're getting united. And they're going to come presenting a united front against the Israelites. All of them are united except for one group, and that's what we'll read about next. "When the inhabitants of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done to Jericho and Ai, they also acted craftily and set out as envoys and took worn-out sacks on their donkeys and wineskins, worn out and torn and mended, and worn out and patched sandals on their feet, and worn out clothes on themselves, and all the bread of their provision was dry, and had become crumbled. And they went to Joshua to the camp at Gilgal, and said to him and to the men of Israel, 'We have come from a far country. Now therefore, make a covenant with us.' And the men of Israel said to the Hivites, 'Perhaps you are living within our land. How then shall we make a covenant with you?' But they said to Joshua, 'We are your servants.' Then Joshua said to them, 'Who are you, and where do you come from?' And they said to him, 'Your servants have come from a very far country, because of the fame of the Lord your God. For we have heard the report of him, and all that he did in Egypt, and all that he did to the two kings of the Amorites, who are beyond the Jordan, to Sihon, king of Heshbon, and to Og, king of Bashan, who was at Ashtaroth. So our elders and all the inhabitants of our country spoke to us, saying, "Take provisions in your hand for the journey, and go to meet them, and say to them, "We are your servants. Now then, make a covenant with us. This, our bread, was warm when we took it from our provisions out of our houses on the day that we left to come to you. But now, behold, it is dry and has become crumbled. And these wineskins were filled with new, and behold, they are torn. And these, our clothes and our sandals, are worn out because of the very long journey. So the men of Israel took some of their provisions and did not ask for the counsel of the Lord. And Joshua made peace with them and made a covenant with them to let them live. And the leaders of the congregation swore an oath to them. So the Gibeonites have a different response from the rest of the people of Canaan. They don't want to fight against the Israelites. They are convinced that the Israelites will win, and they don't want to be destroyed. They want to come to peace terms with the people of Israel. And they do so by acting craftily. It says verse 4, they also acted craftily. Well, what does it mean, they also acted craftily? Well, also because the Israelites had acted craftily with respect to Ai. Now, I suspect that we're supposed to make a connection here, and the nature of the connection we'll have to come back to, but I think we're supposed to be making a connection here. What they do here is very clever, and it's almost comical. They go to great lengths to make it appear that they have come from a very far away place. Old clothes, old sandals, old wineskins, tired donkeys, bread that's old, and I guess it doesn't mold there. I guess it does something else, but it's old. They come and they say, we'd like to make peace with you. And Joshua's first response is, well, how do I know you've come from a long ways away? How do I know you aren't one of the inhabitants of the land that we are going to take and that we are to destroy? And they say, well, just look at us. I mean, we've got old clothes on. Our sandals are wearing through. Here, try some bread. They've got all the facts on their side. And it says in verse 14, so the men of Israel took some of their provisions and did not ask for the counsel of the Lord. So they took things at face value and they did not inquire of the Lord. And Joshua made a covenant with the people of Gibeon. Next section. And it came about at the end of 3 days, after they had made a covenant with them, that they heard that they were neighbors and that they were living within their land. Then the sons of Israel set out and came to their cities on the third day. Now their cities were Gibeon and Japhirah and Beeroth and Kiriath Jearim. And the sons of Israel did not strike them because the leaders of the congregation had sworn to them by the Lord, the God of Israel. And the whole congregation grumbled against the leaders. But all the leaders said to the whole congregation, we have sworn to them by the Lord, the God of Israel, and now we cannot touch them. This we will do to them. Even let them live, lest wrath be upon us for the oath which we swore to them. And the leaders said to them, let them live. So they became hewers of wood and drawers of water for the whole congregation, just as the leaders had spoken to them. So they find out just a few days later from people living in the area that those Gibeonites weren't from a long ways away. They are from just down the road. And the people of Israel are upset. They are upset with their leaders who had made this agreement. The people would like to destroy these Gibeonites. But the leaders say, no, we can't do that. We made an oath, and we swore by God that we would not touch them. So they say, we cannot kill them. Instead, the people, the leaders of Israel, make the Gibeonites to be servants of Israel. They'll be woodcutters and water carriers. both for the temple as well as for the whole congregation of Israel. And the last section. Then Joshua called for them and spoke to them, saying, "Why have you deceived us, saying, 'We are very far from you,' when you are living within our land? Now therefore you are cursed, and you shall never cease being slaves, both hewers of wood and drawers of water, for the house of my God." So they answered Joshua and said, "Because it was certainly told your servants that the Lord your God had commanded his servant Moses to give you all the land and destroy all the inhabitants of the land before you, therefore we feared greatly for our lives because of you and have done this thing. And now behold, we are in your hands. Do as it seems good and right in your sight to do to us." Thus he did to them, and delivered them from the hands of the sons of Israel, and they did not kill them. But Joshua made them that day hewers of wood and drawers of water for the congregation and for the altar of the Lord to this day in the place which he would choose. So Joshua confronts them and says, "Why did you deceive us?" And their answer is very simple. Their answer is, "We knew that God had given to Moses this land, and that you were coming to wipe out the inhabitants and to take this land. And the Gibeonites are confident that that would come to pass." So they're saying, "We would rather live than be destroyed. Now we realize that we're in a position where we're at your mercy." And they say, "Do with us as you see fit." And Joshua makes them servants. What's interesting here is they have some understanding of what's going on. And they understand that this land has been given by God to Israel, and they are going to take this land. They may not have quite as much understanding as Rahab. They may be a little bit more self-preservationist than was Rahab, but they have some understanding. That's what brings me to my dilemma. I'm not sure how to take this. I'm not sure how we're supposed to think about the Gibeonites, and I'm not sure how we're supposed to think about the decision that was made by the leaders of Israel. It says that they did not take counsel of the Lord. Were they supposed to take counsel of the Lord for every decision that they made? Were they supposed to, at every turn, at every juncture, were they supposed to go to the Urim and Thummim and get God's reading on what they were supposed to do? I think not. I don't think that's what God intended. We certainly don't see God encouraging them, generally speaking, to constantly turn to the Urim and Thummim. It was pointed out by some commentaries that they didn't consult God before they attacked Ai the first time, and they were defeated. And that's an indication that they were supposed to consult the Urim and Thummim. They were defeated not because they didn't consult God. They were defeated because Achan had sinned. So if God wants them to consult the Urim and Thummim at every turn, he missed an opportunity to impress that upon his people. So I don't think that God really is wanting them to consult him at every decision. What is wrong here? Why did they do wrong in not consulting God in this particular instance? It seems to me that's not clear. It just says that they didn't consult God. It doesn't say that they did wrong in not consulting God. Nor are they chastised later in the account for not having consulted God. So did they do wrong in not consulting God? Well, now we come back to what is the significance of the verse where it says they also acted craftily. Now, I don't know what we're supposed to associate there. What is the same about this instance in which the Gibeonites acted craftily, and in Ai, where the people of Israel acted craftily? Is it just that both acted craftily and nothing more than that? Or is it that there is the same dynamic at place, at work? At Ai, the reason the plan worked is because the people of Ai had become overconfident. Is it possible that that's what's being suggested here? That the people, the leaders of Israel, had become a little too self-confident? That they have decided that they can make decisions without concern for what God wants? I don't know. That's kind of tenuous, but I think it's at least worthy of consideration. And if they had consulted God, what would God have said? That too, that's unclear. He may have indicated that they had come from far away, but I'm not sure what he would have said with respect to how they should treat these people. There are two times, once in Exodus and once in Deuteronomy. In Exodus it's 23:32, and in Deuteronomy it's 7:2, where God tells the people of Israel when they go into the land, they are supposed to kill all of the inhabitants. However, there is provision made in Deuteronomy 20. Let's look at that one. Deuteronomy 20, 10 through 12. Now, when I first read this, I thought it was giving terms for when they go into the land of Canaan. But I think, when I reread it, I think there's a change. This is talking about when they engage in warfare in general. And then when it's in Israel itself, the rules of engagement are a little more strict. And we get to that in verse 15. But let me read this. When you approach a city to fight against it, you shall offer it terms of peace. And it shall come about, if it agrees to make peace with you and opens to you, then it shall be that all the people who are found in it shall become your forced labor and shall serve you. However, if it does not make peace with you, but makes war against you, then you shall besiege it. When the Lord your God gives it into your hand, you shall strike all the men in it with the edge of the sword. Only the women and the children and the animals and all that is in the city, all its spoil, you shall take as booty for yourself. And you shall use the spoil of your enemies, which the Lord your God has given you. Thus you shall do for all the cities that are very far from you, which are not of the cities of these nations nearby. Only in the cities of these peoples that the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance, you shall not leave alive anything that breathes, but you shall utterly destroy them, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Canaanite, and the Perizzite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite, as the Lord your God has commanded you, in order that they may not teach you to do according to all their detestable things, which they have done for their gods, so that you would sin against the Lord your God. So I think these are just in general, this is the way that you are to conduct warfare. But in the conquest, you're to kill everybody. So I think 15 on is different in talking about this particular situation of the conquest. If that's the case, then what they were instructed to do was to eliminate the population of Canaan. And that would include the Gibeonites. But what Joshua did, having made the promise to the Gibeonites, he did what was said to do to those cities that capitulate, that are far away. That is, they will become your servants. Okay, so it would appear that they violated what God had asked them to do. That they should not have made this agreement with the Gibeonites, and they should have investigated it more thoroughly. However, I was looking for some sign in the rest of the Old Testament that the Gibeonites were the source of some difficulty for Israel. That would have made it easier. That later on, that what they had done here would come back to haunt. And I couldn't find a clear sign that that was the case. In fact, look at 2 Samuel 21, verse 1. This is talking about events during the time of David. Saul had been the king just prior to David, and then David became, I think at this point David is king. 2 Samuel 21, verse 1. Now there was a famine in the days of David for 3 years, year after year. And David sought the presence of the Lord. And the Lord said, "It is for Saul and his bloody house, because he put the Gibeonites to death." So the king called the Gibeonites and spoke to them. Now the Gibeonites were not of the sons of Israel, but of the remnant of the Amorites. And the sons of Israel made a covenant with them, but Saul had sought to kill them in his zeal for the sons of Israel and Judah. Thus David said to the Gibeonites, "What should I do for you, and how can I make atonement, that you may bless the inheritance of the Lord?" Then the Gibeonites said to him, "We have no concern of silver or gold with Saul or his house, nor is it for us to put any man to death in Israel." And he said, "I will do for you whatever you say." So they said to the king, "The man who consumed us and who planned to exterminate us from remaining within any border of Israel, let 7 men from his sons be given to us, and we will hang them before the Lord in Gibeah of Saul, the chosen of the Lord." And the king said, "I will give them." So Saul apparently had sought to exterminate the Gibeonites. And because he had sought to exterminate the Gibeonites, God sent a famine for 3 years to afflict Israel and Judah. And David responded by that for asking, "What can I do to atone for this that has been done?" And what the Gibeonites asked for is 7 of the children of Saul. So, God comes to the defense of the Gibeonites later on. They don't seem to be a source of trouble. I couldn't find an indication that they were a source of trouble later in Israel. There is one curious verse, however, in Hosea. I hope I can find Hosea. Hosea 10:1. And I didn't have time to look at this in detail, but it seems to suggest that what the Israelites did here was wrong. Hosea 10:9. "From the days of Gibeah you have sinned, O Israel. There they stand. Will not the battle against the sons of iniquity overtake them in Gibeah?" Now, what is that in reference to? Is that in reference to this event? Or is it in reference to some other event? I can't say for sure. But it's possible that this would be referring back to this decision here. I'm not sure what to make of this decision on the part of the Israelites to make an agreement with Gibeah, whether they were wrong or whether they were right. But as I was thinking about it, it occurred to me that it seems to me there's a sense in which the Gibeonites were trying to respond to God. It doesn't seem to be as clear as in the case of Rahab, but they seem to understand some things, and they're willing to be the lowliest of people within the Israelite community in order to be allowed to live and to be a part of it. And it seems to me that there's something good in that. And it caused me to reflect on something that I have found to be true of God and I find to be very important. And that is that whenever we reach out to God, whenever we're trying to be what he wants us to be, to relate to him the way that he wants us to relate to him, I find that all of my gestures are clumsy. They're always with mixed motives. It's always impure. It's always, it's oftentimes kind of wrong-headed, bumbling, kind of juvenile. Just, I don't know how to reach out to God. But God is a gracious God, and I keep reminding myself that it's not just me reaching out to God. But there's a more important reciprocal action, and that is God drawing me to Him. And that He's much better at doing that than my clumsy efforts on this end. And that God is capable of bringing people along in very, very strange ways. And no matter how clumsy our efforts towards Him, He's able to make that connection and help us to come along and come to understand Him and relate to Him rightly. And I'm not sure that that's true of Gibeah here, but I think it's possible that's the picture that we see. That they're clumsily trying to respond rightly to these events that are taking place. And they've got mixed motives. But nevertheless, it's a step in the right direction. And God brings them in and gives them a place to live among the Israelites. Okay, help, questions, comments?
Okay, you said this was a work session, right?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I noticed a couple of things that were interesting to me, and perhaps you noticed them as well. Back in Deuteronomy 20, where you took us,
mm-hmm.
The Hivites are mentioned specifically as one of the inhabitants that they're supposed to utterly destroy.
Right.
And even though in all cases except for one that I could see in Joshua 9, the people are referred to as the Gibeonites, there's one place in verse 7 where it says the men of Israel said to the Hivites.
Mm-hmm.
So evidently that's another name for the Gibeonites.
They seem to be, the Gibeonites seem to be a subset of the Hivites.
Okay. So I just wanted to point that out. You probably saw that already. I wanted to make a comment about the instructions that God gave Israel back in Deuteronomy about offering terms.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that the Gibeonites, that Israel was treating the Gibeonites as those who, if they had been offered terms of peace, would have accepted them rather than be destroyed. So even though Israel did not initiate that discussion,
mm-hmm.
The Gibeonites fulfilled the requirement that God gave Israel to be spared.
Right.
So I'm not sure that Israel did anything wrong or that they shouldn't have done in this mm-hmm. case. It strikes me that they responded appropriately to what was really a statement of surrender by the Gibeonites.
Right. That is, provided that the instructions that are being listed in 10 through 14 are applicable to people who live in Canaan.
Right, good point. That might not be the case. Thank you. And I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
It just occurred to me, and I don't think this is the first time, there doesn't seem to be anything of a communication barrier between the Israelites and the Canaanites.
Yeah.
What's going on with that? They can't speak the same language, can they?
I don't know. My suspicion is that there are some among the Israelites that can speak something similar to the Canaanite language. David Roper pointed out years ago, and I assume it's still true, that Moses was born in a time when the Egyptians had driven out can't remember the name of the group that came in from the north. there's a group that came in and attacked. It took over Egypt for a period of time. The Hyksos. And the Hyksos were driven out. And then it's true Egyptians then that take over. Moses would have been born when the true Egyptians had taken over again. When they took over again, they no longer were indifferent to what happened to political events in Palestine, because it was from there that the Hyksos had come down and attacked them. So the Egyptians decide, for our security, we need from here on out to always be concerned about what's happening in Palestine. So they sent campaigns on a regular basis into Palestine to beat up on the Canaanites. And they not only beat up on them, but they would take the son of the king of each city and take him down to Egypt to be raised in the household of the Pharaoh. And it was ostensibly a goodwill gesture on their part, but it was also security on Egypt's part. Because if that city in Canaan were to rebel against Egyptian power, they'd lose a prince. As a result, when Moses was being raised up, he was being raised, he could very well have been raised up amidst a whole bunch of Canaanites, and would have had access to a lot of information about Canaan, the language, the culture, the people, the traditions, etc., etc. So even if I suspect as well that the Israelites had kept some of their language and culture, I don't know that for sure, but it wouldn't surprise me what they passed that on as well. And the language that they spoke would have been essentially the same as, basically the same as the Canaanite language. So I think they knew quite a bit. And they spent 40 years going through the wilderness where they're on the fringes of the Canaanite society anyway. I suspect they've absorbed quite a bit. So they seem to be pretty comfortable moving around within Canaanite society and communicating. I suspect they don't need interpreters.
I was looking through the Hosea passage that you brought mm-hmm. up, and I'm wondering if it actually is the same city.
Mm-hmm.
In Judges later on, it talks about the wickedness of Gibeah.
Mm-hmm.
There's a passage in Judges 19 where basically it looks pretty close to be Sodom and Gomorrah. The same situation happens where someone's wandering through. And
mm-hmm.
anyway, additionally to that, in Joshua 18, it lists the cities that are given to Benjamin.
Mm-hmm.
It lists Gibeon first, and then later on it lists Gibeah second.
Mm-hmm.
And they're listed as two separate cities or villages. So I'm wondering if maybe that Hosea passage, and it's talking about the wickedness of Gibeah, may not be related to Gibeon, which
mm-hmm.
I don't know if that'd make a difference, but...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I don't know whether Gibeah and Gibeon are separate things. In one of the books I consulted, it says it's the same place, but I don't know.
If you look at something like Jonah, an absolute is actually conditional. There's an implied conditional. You're going to be destroyed. Nineveh is going to be destroyed, except they repented, so
right.
they weren't destroyed.
Right.
It seems to me that a lot of the commands throughout, a lot of God's commands, there's an implied conditional on them. So even though, furthermore, God tells them why he wants them to destroy all the Canaanites.
Mm-hmm.
It's because their religious practices have become so degraded that he doesn't want them to be adopted by Israel, and he doesn't want the Israelites to be influenced by their degraded religious practices. The Gibeonites here sound like they're believing. They've heard what God has promised Moses, and their response to that is not to reject it and get defensive about it being their land. They say, if your God has given it to you, I guess it's your land. Can we serve you?
Mm-hmm.
And that just seems to be an incredibly believing response.
Right.
The problem is Joshua has a commandment to kill everybody, so I wonder, just as God had used craft to capture Ai, he's enabling the Gibeonites to use craft to get mercy here,
right,
in the face of what will not be their fate if they just are straightforward about it.
Right. We better stop, but for the out of mercy on those taking care of children. Thanks.